He missed the best one.
Yeah.
Don't
that's all right. It's recorded. So tonight we're going to look at the just war theory. I'm going to look at a few things. I'm going to look at the just war theory. I'm going to look at what the Constitution has to say about making war, what the Founding Fathers had to say about it. And then lastly, we're going to look at how war is a major cause of paper money and inflation and all that kind of stuff, bad monetary policy. And we're going to look at what the Scripture has to say about that. Most of this stuff, unfortunately, tonight, this is going to be unlike a normal Bible study for me in that there's not going to be a whole lot of Bible. I'm just going to be reading a bunch of other stuff. But this should, I think, hopefully show from what Christian philosophers have come up with that this just war theory really is based in the Scripture and matches up quite closely with what I've been showing you, for, especially the last study last week. So anyway, I'm going to be doing a lot of reading here. But this is the just war theory. It was, I think, originally started by Augustine back in the 300s. And then Thomas Aquinas did a lot of work on this. I don't know if there's an official just war theory, if it's all spelled out. This was on Wikipedia. So this just war theory is broken up into three parts. It's jus ad bellum, which is Latin for the right to go to war. And then jus in bello, which is right conduct within war. And then jus post bellum, which is justice after war. David, I'm going to take questions after the study, so pipe down. All right. And so anyway, just war theory. So jus ad bellum is the right to go to war. So, and this is broken down into about six things here. First of all, I'm going to read these, and then I'm going to comment on how our foreign policy lines up with this stuff. Just cause. It's the reason for going to war needs to be just and cannot therefore be solely for recapturing things taken or punishing people who have done wrong. Innocent life must be in imminent danger, and intervention must be to protect life. And then it says a contemporary view of this just cause was expressed in 1993 when the U.S. Catholic Conference said, quote, force may be used only to correct a grave public evil, i.e. aggression or massive violation of basic human rights of whole populations. So I don't know how much credibility the Catholic Church has with telling us when we can go to war or not. Maybe they should have taken their own advice back in the Inquisition. But yeah, in the Crusades, yeah. So anyway, I mean, I think that they have about 50 million people's blood on their hands. No exaggeration. Probably as many as any one government probably has ever had. So anyway, so you have to have a just cause to go to war. Innocent lives must be in immediate danger. Intervention must be to protect life. Our intervention is just the opposite. I mean, nobody's life here in our country is in immediate danger at all. We intervene to take life, not to save it. You know, we go over there and mess around in other people's countries. Number two, comparative justice. It says, while there may be rights and wrongs on all sides of a conflict, to overcome the presumption against the use of force, the injustice suffered by one party must significantly outweigh that suffered by another. Some theorists, such as Brian Oren, omit this term, seeing it as fertile ground for exploitation by bellicose regimes. It just almost kills me to even read this stuff and think of our own foreign policy. The comparative justice, the rights. So if we're going to wrong, or if we're going to right a wrong, what we do, the wrong had to be big enough for us to do it and to justify for what we do. But the thing is, we're the one doing the wrong. I mean, nobody's wronged us in all these wars. Like, what did Vietnam do to us? What did Iraq do to us? What did Afghanistan do to us? None of them did anything. I mean, Afghanistan, supposedly Al-Qaeda was there. But if you really look at it, in Afghanistan, if you buy the whole story, the 9/11 story, 15 of the 19 hijackers were from Saudi Arabia. Mm-hmm. So, and even if the hijackers were from Afghanistan, the Constitution has a thing called mark and reprisal, mm-hmm. where you can go in there with basically a very defined force, go in there, take out a threat, and come home, where you're not going to war against the government or something. What we did was far from mark and reprisal. We went in there and had a war for 12 years on end, and it's just unreal. But anyway, mm-hmm. Number three is competent authority. Only duly constituted public authorities may wage war. A just war must be initiated by a public authority within a political system that allows distinctions of justice. Dictatorships, example, Hitler's regime, or deceptive military actions, example, the 1968 U.S. bombing of Cambodia, are typically considered as violations of this criterion. The importance of this condition is key. Plainly, we cannot have a genuine process of judging a just war within a system that represses the process of genuine justice. A just war must be initiated by a political authority within a political system that allows distinctions of justice. Number one, I mean, our competent authority, according to the Constitution, is the Congress that declares war, not the president, as has been with Libya and now Syria. And really, even Congress authorized Afghanistan and Iraq, but they didn't declare war anyway, so our competent authority is not being followed. So as you see, we're 0 for 3 so far on the just war idea.
Can you run through the three again? Just not the definition, sure. Uh-huh. But just the categories?
Yep, so it's a just cause.
Just cause.
Comparative justice. Competent authority.
These are reasons why you could go to war.
Well, you can, yes.
Be okay.
These are the conditions that must be in order to go to war under the just war theory and to be legitimate. You have to have a right intention. That's the next one. Force may be used only in a truly just cause and solely for that purpose. Correcting a suffered wrong is considered a right intention, while material gain or maintaining economies is not. Well, I think it's no secret that a lot of times when we go to war, it's either for economic reasons, the military-industrial complex, that a lot of these Pentagon contractors get all kinds of loot from this kind of thing, or, what did it say here, material gain or maintaining economies. A lot of times, too, they have this mistaken Keynesian idea that war brings prosperity and war brings you out of depression. They use that example, World War II. They said World War II brought us out of the depression, which is hardly the case. I mean, it's not true at all. We were in a depression in World War II, and whenever we came back from World War II, they cut spending by some amazing amount, like 75% or something like that. Majorly cut back taxes, majorly cut back spending, majorly cut back regulation. And we were the only country left in the world that had any productive capacity, and we went without for a lot of years in World War II. They rationed gasoline and all kinds of stuff. Mm-hmm. So we went through a depression to get through that whole thing. I mean, the World War II did not bring us out of the depression. That is a misnomer. But anyway, that's beside the point. If I don't quit jabbering on every point, I'm never going to get through this. You have to have a probability of success is number five. Number five. Probability of success. Arms may not be used in a futile cause or in a cause where disproportionate measures are required to achieve success. So, if you have no chance of winning, like Jesus told the parable of the one king going against the other king, the other king had 20,000, he had 10,000, count the cost. If there's no chance of winning, it would be, I mean, that's not a just war. You know, some suicide mission is not a just war. That doesn't make any sense. Also, if it takes disproportionate measures that are required to achieve success, so if we say we're going to go to war against China, but there's no way we have enough foot soldiers to do it, we're going to go in there, we're going to drop 15 strategically placed hydrogen bombs and just completely turn that country into glass. That would not fall under this of a probability of success, because in order to have success, a disproportionate measure would be required to achieve that success. Mm-hmm. So, and I think there's another, proportionalities will come up here in just a minute.
So that takes terrorism out. If you're an oppressed people, you can't go bomb civilian or stop targets.
Yes. Yep.
And you're outnumbered, you can't really.
Yep. Absolutely. Yep. Yeah, exactly. Terrorism would be prohibited by that. And I think there's another, as I remember reading through this, there's another one that would be, where you can't kill civilians, and I'm not sure. That's probably right conduct within war. I'll get to that one next one here. Sixthly, last resort. Force may be used only after all peaceable and viable alternatives have been seriously tried and exhausted and are clearly not practical. it may be clear that the other side is using negotiations as a delaying tactic and will not make meaningful concessions. So in order to go to war justly, it has to be a last resort. Diplomacy has been tried, everything's been tried, and nothing has worked, and this truly is a last resort. All viable options have been tried and exhausted. And like I said, I mean, it's just superfluous to even think about our foreign policy in light of this last resort thing. I mean, we don't have to go to any of these wars. I mean, none of them were even necessary. So to say a last resort, well, we gave Saddam 48 hours to get out of Baghdad, it was a last resort because he didn't listen. I mean, that's just all nonsense. I mean, that's crazy. And by the way, do you hear what happened with Egypt today? Mm-hmm. Military just did a coup and overthrew the government that they just put in a year ago that we helped install. We helped the rebellion. So now they say they're putting the constitution on hold and until they can get another one written. And yeah.
So the military's in charge.
Military's in charge, yeah. Mm-hmm. Throughout, what's the guy's name? Anyway, Mubarak was the first guy. I forget this guy's name anyway, but it's a complete mess over there. Mm. Go figure. And we're still sending them millions of dollars a year in aid. Yeah, hundreds of millions of dollars every year. We sold them 20 F-16 fighter jets here earlier this year.
Mm.
It's crazy. It's just crazy. Mm. Proportionality is the seventh one. The anticipated benefits of waging a war must be proportionate to its expected evils or harms. This principle is also known as the principle of macro proportionality, so as to distinguish it from the just in bello, which is right conduct within war, principle of proportionality. So there's proportionality in going to right to go to war and once your conduct in war.
Gotcha.
So this proportionality, the anticipated benefits have to be proportional to the expected evils or harms. So if it's going to cause you to lose basically your entire military and destroy your country, but you'll probably win, it doesn't make sense. It's not probable. The proportion of harm done versus the benefit of it is not going to, would not be profitable for you.
Vietnam, 60,000 U.S. troops dead.
Absolutely. And I think I just heard just recently, like, hundreds of thousands committed suicide after that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, throughout the years.
Mm-hmm. Residual damage.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And you know now, there are 23 soldiers per month committing suicide coming back from Afghanistan, and Iraq and Afghanistan, way more than are being killed in Afghanistan. 23 on the average per month committing suicide. Mm. It's awful. It's absolutely awful. They're just ruining a whole generation. Mm-hmm. They really are. Just like Vietnam did. Vietnam largely ruined a whole generation. There's still a lot of guys that are really messed up from that.
That's right.
It's really
Everyone
sad.
Knows a couple of Vietnam vets that really struggled.
Absolutely. So Justin Bello now is the right conduct within war. So we saw the right to go to war, which I'll just reiterate, was just cause, comparative justice, competent authority, right intention, probability of success, last resort, and proportionality. Now, right conduct within war is distinction, which means just war conduct should be governed by the principle of distinction. The acts of war should be directed towards enemy combatants and not towards non-combatants caught in circumstances they did not create.
That's right.
The prohibited acts include bombing civilian residential areas that include no military targets and committing acts of terrorism or reprisal against citizens. Moreover, combatants are not permitted to target with violence enemy combatants who have surrendered or who have been captured or who are injured and not presenting an immediate lethal threat. There's a lot to be said in there. Number one, civilians should never be targeted. So yeah, I mean that takes away terrorism. That take a lot of the stuff like the rules of engagement. When we went into Iraq, I was not on the front line, but I knew people that came back from it that were, and they said some of the rules of engagement were anybody. It doesn't matter. Somebody runs out in that street, kill them. It doesn't matter who they are. And I'm not sure what the reason was for all that, but that's against the Geneva Convention and all the other, what do they call that?
Articles of War?
Rules of engagement is what I was trying to think of, yeah.
In World War II, you had the Dresden firebombing over Germany, the civilian targets, I believe, and then you had Nagasaki and Hiroshima.
Absolutely.
In Japan.
Yeah.
And these civilian targets. I mean, a lot of troops, they say, were saved. Otherwise, U.S. Marines would have landed and would have been bloodbath. Yeah. But this sort of would violate that principle.
I would think so. I mean, because they just wiped out those entire cities, which certainly wasn't only military targets.
Right.
Furthermore, this prohibits torture also of people that are of combatants that have been caught that are no longer a threat. You have to treat them justly, and you know, like Jesus said, if your enemy thirsts, feed him. If he's hungry, give him water. Or you know what I mean? Yeah, you know what I'm trying to say. Oh, just call me Pastor Bush. So I'm glad I can provide you guys with some comedic relief.
Thank you, Pastor Bush.
Helps to break it up. So anyway, I mean, this is obviously prohibit Guantanamo Bay. We're out there. We're torturing all these guys down there. These poor guys are having hunger strikes to just try to kill themselves because they're so miserable being kept in solitary confinement, all kinds of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And moreover, this would include distinguishing between enemy combatants and our own troops, like Bradley Manning, who does nothing more than blow the whistle on violations of this very principle that we're talking about tonight. And then he ends up, right, and he's been in prison for 3 years and kept in solitary confinement, made to sleep in his cell naked and all kinds of stuff. Mm-hmm. Poor kid. I mean, just for showing that we were killing civilians and all kinds of stuff in Iraq and mm-hmm. spilling the beans on that. Terrible. And the same thing. If they catch Edward Snowden, I feel bad for that guy.
Absolutely.
Because he'll be tortured, he'll be, mm-hmm. who knows what. I mean, and he knows it. I'm sure he knows it.
They ought to build a statue of those guys and put them up in our squares.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, yeah, as far as I'm concerned, Edward Snowden's a hero. Bradley Manning's a hero.
That's right.
Absolutely. Proportionality. So this is the second proportionality. It's just war conduct should be governed by the principle of proportionality. An attack cannot be launched on a military objective in the knowledge that the incidental civilian injuries would be clearly excessive in relation to the anticipated military advantage, principle of proportionality, which is what you were talking about with Nagasaki and Hiroshima. If to do it is going to create a large loss in civilian casualties, collateral damage, as we call it, you know. I love how we use all these euphemisms. But anyway, if it's going to cause too much civilian casualty, then that is not just, according to the just war theory.
Mm-hmm.
Military necessity. Just war conduct should be governed by the principle of minimum force. An attack or action must be intended to help in the military defeat of the enemy. It must be an attack on a military objective, and the harm caused to civilians or civilian property must be proportional and not excessive in relation to the concrete and direct military advantage anticipated. This principle is meant to limit the excessive and unnecessary death and destruction. And that's why, like, when we were in Iraq, I mean, the military is not totally crazy. They didn't, like, you had the Mark 19s, which are fully automatic grenade launchers, which could just, I mean, you could just destroy whole city blocks with that thing, I'm sure, just launching grenades, you know, a couple every second. And so they were not allowed to use those once the combat operations were over. I mean, when you got guys escorting convoys up to the Turkey border or something, you don't have Mark 19s on the Humvees to start lobbing grenades like crazy if, you know, I mean, so anyway, that kind of thing, you know, you don't make undue damage. You don't go in there and just completely, once the enemy's been defeated, you just don't wipe them out like it did in the South in the Civil War. Just burnt entire towns and everything.
Right, the Red Boots.
Yep. Like we did in Japan too. I've been told that Japan surrendered, well, they just surrendered before the A-bombs. But they also, once they had surrendered, we didn't accept their surrender. We went in there and firebombed things and just destroyed entire villages and I guess cities and everything to just, you know, that's what Stuart Crane talked about, urban renewal. Mm-hmm. You know, just destroy it all so you can rebuild it again mm-hmm. the way you want it. And sad. Fair treatment of prisoners of war. Enemy soldiers who surrendered or who are captured no longer pose a threat. It is therefore wrong to torture them or otherwise mistreat them. It says a lot about a people and a military of how you treat your captors.
That's right.
You know, the people, captives. Mm-hmm. That's just terrible. I mean, that's what other wicked nations do. That's not what this one should do.
That's right.
You know, that's what Vietnamese do and Japanese did and just awful things
Chinese
to some of our prisoners of war. And granted, I mean, I think they were propagandized like we were, and they thought, I mean, the Japanese, I know, were told that Americans were just savage beasts, and they would just, I mean, you kill yourself before they catch you because you wouldn't want to be caught by them and everything. So is it any wonder how they treated the soldiers once they did get them in captivity? I mean, I guess if you're told a bunch of lies, but anyway.
We don't have to be as bad as the bad guys.
Exactly, exactly.
And we lose it whenever we do.
That's exactly right. No means malum in si. I don't know what that means. I'm going to explain it to you, though. Soldiers, sounds like some foreign language, probably is. Soldiers may not use weapons or other methods of warfare which are considered evil, such as mass rape, forcing soldiers to fight against their own side, or using weapons whose effects cannot be controlled, example, nuclear or biological weapons. Mm-hmm. You know, which I think is legitimate. It was Einstein that said after World War II, after the A-bomb was created, he said, I may have mentioned this before, he didn't know how World War III would be fought, but World War IV would be fought with rocks, because mm-hmm. after World War III, there's going to be nothing left, mm-hmm. you know, with all the proliferation of nuclear weapons. Okay, so that was right conduct within war. It was distinction, proportionality, military necessity, fair treatment of prisoners of war, and no means malum in si. Now, just postbellum is justice after war. We're going to get into some other, after this is short, and then we're going to get into some of the quotes from the Founding Fathers, and I think that if this is boring you guys to death, then that should be more interesting. But
Pastor Wagner, I've heard some, I think of a Navy SEAL interview I heard where the news is interviewing him, and he was complaining, I think I've heard this from other soldiers that have been in war, saying that people in Congress who write rules of engagement don't know the reality or the tactical reality of the battlefield, and they should just kind of, you know, shut up or pick up their rifle and do their part, you know, mm-hmm. a la Jack Nicholson, mm-hmm. words of substance. How do you deal with that objection as you look at the cool, calm, and collected view of just war and how to conduct yourself in a just mm-hmm. war, and the tactical view of the soldier on the ground over there who just, let's say, saw his comrade's head get blown off?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I would look at that as it's always better to make decisions whenever you're not in the emotion of it. Like mm-hmm. in anything in life, right? You make the decisions when you've backed off from the emotion of it. So I think it would make sense to draw up rules of engagement and not allow soldiers to write their own rules of engagement. Mm-hmm. No different than you know, we have to have search warrants to search somebody's house. You don't let police write their own search warrants because what happens if they get there on site and they just know this guy's guilty and they've got to get in there right now or something. And you end up trouncing on people's liberty and in this case maybe a lot of innocent people's lives, I would suppose, mm-hmm. in war if you allow soldiers or commanders to write their own rules of engagement. I don't know if that's a good answer or not. Mm-hmm. That's kind of what I'm thinking.
You have to impose a discipline over them prior to the engagement, so they're disciplined, and that's why they're a soldier instead of a looter or something.
And there are general, I think what the Congress makes or the Geneva Convention made general rules of engagement, but when we were over there, the rules of engagement would change. Like the commanders had some leeway there based on what was going on to what you can do and what you can't do. Mm-hmm. Like a lot of times we weren't, I mean you wouldn't fire your weapon unless it was an absolute threat. Like there was no doubt about it. Like if we were on a convoy doing security and somebody would be coming up on the convoy, you'd shine a spotlight at them first. You might shine a laser at them. We had flares mounted right in the turrets. You'd fire a flare at them first. You'd fire at the ground then next. I mean, there were very conservative rules of engagement, I guess I would say. But when you're going, I mean, when they were in, I'm not advocating what we did, but whenever you're going in and taking Baghdad for the first time, obviously you're not firing flares and spotlights or anything. So to a certain extent, the commanders can. They do have discretion when it comes to rules of engagement. And I think that makes sense to not. I wouldn't let them write everything, but, you know, within bounds, basically, that they're allowed to do things within certain bounds of law, of just law, law of war. So let's look at just postbellum, which is justice after war. Just cause for termination. In our case, I don't think we even need a just cause for termination. We ought to just terminate, period, in every case and bring them all home. Anyway, this is in a real war, which we haven't fought in a long time. But just cause for termination. A state may terminate a war if there has been a reasonable vindication of the rights that were violated in the first place. Okay, so we had no rights violated in the first place. So we can, you know, that one's, we've met that one. And if the aggressor is willing to negotiate the terms of surrender, okay, so we're the aggressor, so we don't have to worry about that one. The terms of surrender include a formal apology, that would be us, apologizing to them, compensations, yes, that would be us, war crimes trials, that would be for Bush, Cheney, and Obama, and perhaps rehabilitation, and they need some rehabilitation too, absolutely. I agree with this. Alternatively, a state may end a war if it becomes clear that any just goals of the war cannot be reached at all or cannot be reached without using excessive force. So if it gets to the point where you're like, you know what, this is going on forever, like Vietnam. You know, this is just, I mean, supposedly we never lost a battle over there. I mean, we lost 50-some thousand troops. They lost, in the, I don't know, millions, I think, or hundreds of thousands. I mean, it was disproportionate how many were killed, but it was obvious that we weren't going to win it, and especially with China. I think China was, and in Korea too, China was shipping troops in there and everything. And we should have never been there in the first place. I mean, it was totally ridiculous. But anyway, so in that case, it makes sense just to cut your losses and get out. Like Afghanistan, get out. Cut your losses. You're never going to win. You've declared war on an idea, for goodness sake. You can't declare war on an idea and win. You can declare war on a government or a military and win. You can't declare war on an idea. We're going to war on terrorism. I mean, it's ridiculous.
Right.
Absolutely ridiculous. And that's why they do it, though. They're not stupid. They declare war on an idea because they know you can't win, and they know we can be in perpetual war forever.
No way to justly end it.
Yeah, absolutely. You're always going to terrorist. They're going to say, oh, yeah, the terrorists aren't willing to surrender. The terrorists are blah, 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 you know.
And if you have to become a terror over your people who you're trying to keep freedom for in order to combat the terrorists and start hunting them and spying on them and reading their emails,
absolutely.
You cross that line.
Yep, you bet.
You cross that line.
You bet. And I honestly think, I mean, maybe this is the cynic in me, but I think that's the whole purpose. Starting back in 9/11 with the Patriot Act and everything, they know war is a way to take away civil liberties. They know war is a way to set up a police state and take away liberty. And they can justify anything because we're at war and people are scared. And
anyone could be a terrorist, too. Anyone
absolutely.
Can be a combatant. Someone who has a map, a flashlight, a compass, and wears jeans.
Yep.
In some of the police guidebooks, is a suspected terrorist if they're traveling cross country.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And we did that. I think I mentioned this last time. It was in, I think it was in Pakistan or Yemen, one of the two. They had a, it was a tribal meeting of some kind. It was a democratic meeting, like a town hall meeting. They were trying to hash something out. Big group of people there together. Well, some drone operator in New Mexico, 10,000 miles away, flying his drone, looking down there, sees this big meeting of people. It must be an Al-Qaeda terrorist meeting, drops a bunch of bombs on them, killed a whole ton of people. And there's people that were, that village was sympathetic to America. I'm not sure why. Apparently they don't have TV or something. But anyway, they were sympathetic to America. And now, of course, are enemies, which I wouldn't blame them. I would be too. So anyway, yeah, it's terrible. Right intention. A state must only terminate a war under the conditions agreed upon in the above criteria. Revenge is not permitted. The victor state must also be willing to apply the same level of objectivity and investigation into any war crimes its armed forces may have committed. And I say again, Bush, Cheney, Obama, Abu Ghraib prison, all that kind of stuff. All the war crimes that we've committed over there.
And it's even sad, Eisenhower in World War II, the way he handled the German prisoners in a book by Richard Bark, known as Other Losses, talks about them not being allowed to be fed. The German people would try to push it through the gates, the bread and stuff.
Wow.
The typhoid, the lack of clothing. Patton even wrote a letter allegedly to Eisenhower saying the Germans fought like soldiers. They deserve better than this. So this idea of justice after war is very important.
Oh, absolutely. Did you ever read The Art of War by Sun Tzu?
Yes.
Yeah, and he talks about in that too that you never completely destroy and desolate an enemy, and once you have beat them, then treat them with dignity and don't demoralize them and don't make the reparations on them so difficult that they can never pay them back. And I mean, there's a lot of wisdom in that, and that's exactly. What we did to Germany in World War
I
caused World War II.
Versailles Treaty.
Yeah, the Versailles Treaty caused World War II. And they said that. I mean, I forget who said it, but they said, they asked what you've done. They said, what we've done is create war with Germany in 20 years.
It's an English statesman. Yep. I can't remember his name now.
Absolutely. I mean, you can't, you just don't, if you, It's like Gerald Celente says, when people lose everything and they've got nothing left to lose, they lose it. Mm-hmm. So if you make it so difficult, so stringent on a people to where they have reparations that they can never pay back, and you've cut off trade with them, you've just treated them like animals, what are they going to do? They've got nothing left to lose. They're going to lose it, and they're going to, you know, they're going to, you're going to retaliate. Public declaration and authority. The terms of peace must be made by a legitimate authority, and the terms must be accepted by a legitimate authority. And of course, that would be, you know, the president, I suppose, or something like that. Discrimination. The victor state is to differentiate between political and military prisons. The victor state is to differentiate between political and military leaders and combatants and civilians. Punitive measures are to be limited to those directly responsible for the conflict. Truth and reconciliation may sometimes be more important than punishing war crimes. And I think what this guy is saying is just, hey, if you can reconcile with them, it's probably more important than to exact every little thing out of them and make them pay for every little bit of the war or something like that, if you can reconcile and somehow make a peaceful coexistence afterwards. And proportionality. And like I said, proportionality was in all three of these things. Any terms of surrender must be proportional to the rights that were initially violated. Draconian measures, absolutionist crusades, and any attempt at denying the surrendered country the right to participate in the world community are not permitted. And just like we were talking about Germany after World War II, was the same kind of thing. And really, what we're doing to Iran right now prior to war, which is the precursor to war, cutting them off from all international trade, we've destroyed their currency, we don't allow hardly anybody to do any trading with them whatsoever.
I believe we blockaded their waters, if I'm not mistaken.
Yep. So, I mean, what this proportionality says to do after a war, I would say should also be done before a war, and, you know, not try to get yourself into a war. And Ron Paul's been very clear about that, that sanctions are an act of war. And that's what we're doing with Iran, I'm sure of it. Okay, so that was the just war theory. Let's briefly look at what the Constitution says. So not only is the USA, our country, we're not obeying the just war theory, we're not obeying our own supreme law of the land, the Constitution. It says in Article 1, Section 8 of the U.S. Constitution, Congress shall have power to declare war. Congress has not declared war since World War II. Mm-hmm. We've been in a lot of wars since then, and Congress has not declared war. Now they've given the president the War Powers Act, and he can do certain military actions for 60 days, I think it is, and then he can go to Congress and have them approve it afterwards. But even all that's still not a declaration of war, and I think all of that is just undermining the Constitution, just giving the president way too much power. I tried to look for the quote today and I couldn't find it, but I'm sure you've probably heard it before. And it may have been in the Federalist Papers, that may have been where I read it. They gave the power of declaring war to the Congress because they said the executive branch is traditionally the branch that has the most interest in war and will be the most likely to go to war. The kings love to go to war. So when you put it in the legislative branch, you have a lot less chance of going to war and a lot less frequently. Mm-hmm. And that's why they did it. The founders, as you will see here, did not like the idea of going to war. I mean, war to them was a last resort.
But even the War Powers Act, even if they were going to go on that, I mean, Vietnam was longer than 60 days. Korea was longer than 60 days.
But I think Congress allowed the rubber stamp those. The thing is, like with Libya, Congress wasn't even consulted at all, and then that went over 60 days, and Congress was never consulted. So that was clearly a violation of the War Powers Act. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, does this administration or any administration, but does this administration get punished for anything? Mm-hmm. Got Eric Holder selling guns to Mexican drug cartels, and then they get used to kill Border Patrol agents, and that's just one of the many scandals, and nothing happens. Mm-hmm. I mean, you get the IRS scandal and all that stuff, and now the NSA thing, what's his name, dope, gets questioned there in Congress. What's his name, the head of the NSA? Anyway, I can't remember his name. And they asked him, is the NSA collecting information on millions or hundreds of millions or tens of millions of Americans? And he said, no, not intentionally. Clapper's his name. Eric Clapper anyway. just flat out lied. And then afterwards, he admitted that he lied, and he's like, well, I said the best lie I could, or something, or the most honest lie I could, or it was something like that. But just totally lies. Mm. And then Edward Snowden blows the whistle on this whole thing, and somehow he's a traitor, but here this guy lies to Congress, and nothing. Okay, so let's see what the Founding Fathers had to say about war and non-intervention. And boy, if we would just listen to the wisdom of these guys, some of this stuff is just golden. This is George Washington from his farewell address. I'm going to have a few quotes from this. I think this should be required reading for, I would say, every person on the planet, but at least every member of Congress and probably every school child in school, definitely. This is just, this guy was brilliant, absolutely brilliant. He says, hence likewise, they will avoid the necessity of those overgrown military establishments, which, under any form of government, are inauspicious to liberty, and which are to be regarded as particularly hostile to Republican liberty. So what he's saying is that a free people are going to avoid the necessity of overgrown military establishments. He was warning about the military-industrial complex 200 and some years before, not 200 and some, but anyway, 100 and some years prior to Eisenhower warning about it. Mm-hmm. Avoiding overgrown military establishments. He continues with another quote. Observe good faith and justice toward all nations. Cultivate peace and harmony with all. Religion and morality enjoin this conduct. And can it be that good policy does not equally enjoin it? So observe good faith and justice toward all nations. Cultivate peace and harmony with all. Mm-hmm. And he recognizes that if religion and morality teach this, then good public policy should do the same thing. He says, in the execution of such a plan, nothing is more essential than that permanent, inveterate antipathies against particular nations. I'm going to put this in layman's terms here. Sorry. Let me start over, see if I can read this a little more clearly. In the execution of such a plan, nothing is more essential than that permanent, inveterate antipathies against particular nations and passionate attachments for others should be excluded. What he's saying is, don't have some nations that you just hate and that are your enemies all the time and other favorite nations. Don't pick favorites among nations, is what he's saying. And that, in place of them, just and amicable feelings towards all should be cultivated. So we should have nice feelings towards all nations as we can. Treat others nicely. The nation which indulges towards another in habitual hatred or in habitual fondness is in some degree a slave. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. If you have a perpetual hatred or a perpetual fondness, you're going to be a slave to that nation. And I have Israel, mm-hmm. exclamation point, mm-hmm. next to this. We have perpetual fondness toward Israel, and we are a slave to Israel. The American people have been taught to hate all these Islamic countries over there, Iran and all these other people. And what is it getting us? I mean, I'm no Muslim. I have no respect for the Islamic religion whatsoever, but that doesn't mean we need to hate all those nations over there. Mm-hmm. It ends up, I mean, if you hate anybody, you end up being a slave to that hatred. I mean, you are the one that's in captivity. You're not hurting them. You're hurting yourself by hating somebody else. He says, it is a slave to its animosity or to its affection, either of which is sufficient to lead it astray from its duty and its interest. Antipathy in one nation against another disposes each more readily to offer insult or injury, to lay hold of slight causes of umbrage, and to be haughty and intractable when accidental or trifling occasions of dispute occur. So he's saying, if you have an animosity towards a nation, any little thing that happens is going to be blown way out of proportion. You know, Iran could say something, the leader of Iran could say something, it'd be blown completely out of proportion. Netanyahu, the leader of Israel, could say the same thing, and we praise him for it. You know, you know how it is. I mean, the thing that I think is interesting is everything he says here applies to interpersonal conduct.
That's right.
I mean, and that's why I made the point, and you'll hear it, I mean, you listen to the recording, that international conduct should be treated just like interpersonal conduct. Mm-hmm. And I showed in the scripture how that's the case. And so anyway, that's basically what he's saying here. He's validating what I was saying from the scripture. He says, hence, frequent collisions, obstinate, envenomed, and bloody contests. The nation, prompted by ill will and resentment, sometimes impels to war the government, contrary to the best calculations of policy. The government sometimes participates in the national propensity and adopts through passion what reason would reject. See, they're letting their emotions run wild because they have this hatred, this inveterate hatred for another country, and they're not letting reason affect their decisions. At other times, it makes the animosity of the nation subservient to projects of hostility instigated by pride, ambition, and other sinister and pernicious motives. The peace often, sometimes perhaps the liberty of nations has been the victim. He continues, so likewise, a passionate attachment for one nation for another produces a variety of evils. And I say again, Israel.
Mm-hmm.
Sympathy for the favorite nation, facilitating the illusion, listen to this, facilitating the illusion of an imaginary common interest in cases where no real common interest exists.
That's right.
Oh, we all worship the same God,
right.
Us and the Jews over there in Israel do. We're all worshipers of the God of Abraham, and Abraham's our father, and we're both democratic nations, don't
That's
you know?
Right.
And we all believe in freedom and prosperity, and
yep.
Yes, we have common interests. We don't really. And infusing into one the enmities of the other betrays the former into a participation in the quarrels and wars of the latter without adequate inducement or justification. You end up being sucked into their wars. That's exactly what happens to us with Israel. We are sucked into their wars. We end up fighting their fights for them because of our supposed common interests that don't really exist. And one more from Washington in his farewell address. Now, can you imagine Barack Obama, George Bush, any Bill Clinton, any modern president saying anything like this? I mean, these guys couldn't even read this stuff, and I can't really speak. I can't say much about that. But anyway, certainly nothing like this would come out of the White House these days. Not even if it was on a teleprompter, I don't think. The great rule of conduct for us in regard to foreign nations is, in extending our commercial relations, to have with them as little political connection as possible. Amen, Mr. Washington. So far as we have already formed engagements, let them be fulfilled with perfect good faith. Let us stop. He's saying, if we have entangling alliances, political connections, fulfill them. If we have treaties, if we have agreements of some kind, fulfill them in good faith. But no more. End it. He was a very wise man. Listen to Thomas Jefferson, probably an even wiser man. It's amazing, these guys. I don't know. I think Washington was eventually converted. I don't think Jefferson ever was. I think he was always a deist, which is unfortunate, but such a brilliant mind. Jefferson says in his first inaugural address, 1801, he says, equal and exact justice to all men of whatever state or persuasion, religious or political, peace, commerce, and honest friendship with all nations, entangling alliances with none. Absolutely. Why can't we do that? Why can't we have peace, commerce, and honest friendship with all nations and entangling alliances with none? Why can't we do that? Is it what Ron Paul tries to say? I mean, it makes perfect sense. I saw a picture of Ron Paul one time. This was not Jefferson, but it was with, Andrew Jackson. He's got, the big wild hair. They had Andrew Jackson's hair on Ron Paul. It looked awesome. Yeah, and Andrew Jackson, he hated the banks, too. He did away with, I think it was the second bank in the United States, didn't renew his charter, and he said he'd root them out like the vipers they were or something. And, anyway, I don't have any quotes from him, but I'm sure they'd be good. Jefferson says another quote from him. He says, having seen the people of all other nations bow down to the earth under the wars and prodigalities of their rulers, I have cherished their opposites, peace, economy, and riddance of public debt, believing that these were the high road to public as well as private prosperity and happiness. Wise man. He saw other nations buried under wars and debt and everything else, and he cherished the opposite, peace, economy, and riddance of public debt. And lastly from Jefferson, he says, believing that the happiness of mankind is best promoted by the useful pursuits of peace, that on these alone a stable prosperity can be founded, that the evils of war are great in their endurance, and have a long reckoning for ages to come. Boy, isn't that the truth. I have used my best endeavors to keep our country uncommitted in the troubles which afflict Europe and which assail us on every side. And I would say you can just replace Europe with the Middle East now. Mm-hmm. The Middle East are constantly fighting, they're constantly having wars, they're constantly having problems, just like Europe used to. Europe was constantly having wars with each other. And the advice of the founders was, stay out of it. We don't have any business in it. And this is probably my favorite quote. This is from John Quincy Adams, the sixth president of the United States. This was his address to the U.S. House of Representatives, July 4th, 1821. I think this was when he was the Secretary of State. I'm not positive on that. Listen to this. This is one of the best speeches ever, in my opinion. He says, it's kind of lengthy, but there's some really good stuff in here. He says, America, in the Assembly of Nations, since her admission among them, has invariably, though often fruitlessly, held forth to them the hand of honest friendship, of equal freedom, of generous reciprocity. So we tried to do the right thing with other nations. A lot of times it was fruitless and it didn't really have any good effect, but we tried anyway, is what he's saying. She has uniformly spoken among them, though often to heedless and often to disdainful ears, the language of equal liberty, of equal justice, and of equal rights. She has, in the lapse of nearly half a century, without a single exception, respected the independence of other nations while asserting and maintaining her own. Half a century, respected the independence of other nations, weren't mingling in their affairs. Listen to this. She has abstained from interference in the concerns of others, even when conflict has been for principles to which she clings. You see that? She's abstained from interference in the concerns of other nations, even when conflict has been for principles to which she clings. Even when America completely agreed with what some other nation was doing or going through, we still abstained from it. Even when we were 100% in support of it, we still didn't intervene. We didn't have any interference. As to the last vital drop that visits the heart, she has seen that probably for centuries to come, all the contest of that Akeldama, the European world, will be contest of inveterate power and emerging right. Wherever the standard of freedom and independence shall be or shall be unfurled, there will her heart, her benedictions, and her prayers be. Listen to this. This is one of my favorite quotes of all time. But she goes not abroad in search of monsters to destroy. She is the well-wisher to the freedom and independence of all. She is the champion and vindicator only of her own. Mm-hmm. The well-wisher of all, but the champion and vindicator only of her own independence. Mm-hmm. Goes not in search of monsters to destroy. She will commend the general cause by the countenance of her voice and the benignant sympathy of her example. She well knows that by once enlisting under other banners than her own, were they even the banners of foreign independence, she would involve herself beyond the power of extrication in all the wars of interest and intrigue, of individual avarice, envy, and ambition, which assume the colors and usurp the standard of freedom. I mean, that's exactly what we're doing in Libya and Syria right now. Look what he says there. She well knows that by once enlisting under other banners than her own, so we jump in and we help the rebels in Libya or the rebels in Syria, we're enlisting under a banner other than our own. Were they even the banners of foreign independence? We're fighting for the independence of these people, right, supposedly. She would involve herself beyond the power of extradition or extrication. She could not get herself out of it. You'd end up stuck in those situations. Mm-hmm. And in all the wars of interest and intrigue, wow. The fundamental maxims of her policy would insensibly change from liberty to force. Man, you think that these guys were prophets,
right?
And they could see 200 years in the future what's going to happen, or 100 and some years.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing. The frontlet on her brows would no longer beam with the ineffable splendor of freedom and independence, but in its stead would soon be substituted for imperial... But in its stead would soon be substituted an imperial diadem flashing in false and tarnished luster, the murky radiance of dominion and power. That's exactly what we have. We're just an imperial monarch now. She might become the dictatress of the world. Let me say that again. She might become the dictatress of the world, or the dictator in a female form of the world. She would be no longer the ruler of her own spirit. Her glory is not dominion, but liberty. Her march is the march of the mind. John Quincy Adams. And here's some excerpts out of the Monroe Doctrine. This is a doctrine that we had. This is back in 1823, and this is something that we followed for a long time, probably, I don't know, well up into the last century, I would say, that we basically didn't interfere in other nations' entanglements. And it says here, and this was drafted, I don't think James Monroe, the President Monroe, wrote it himself, but anyway, this was under his authority anyway. It says, in the wars of the European powers and matters relating to themselves, we have never taken any part, nor does it comport with our policy to do so, or so to do. So we've never got involved in these European wars, and we're never going to. It is only when our rights are invaded or seriously menaced that we resent injuries or make preparation for our defense. So only if we are directly affected and we're directly attacked. Same doctrine here, Monroe Doctrine. Our policy in regard to Europe, which was adopted at an early stage of the wars, which have so long agitated that quarter of the globe, nevertheless remains the same, which is not to interfere in the internal concerns of any of its powers, to consider the government de facto as the legitimate government for us, to cultivate friendly relations with it, and to preserve those relations by a frank, firm, and manly policy, meeting in all instances the just claims of every power, submitting to injuries from none. Mm-hmm. Basically, we're not going to interfere with you, but we're also not going to put up with any crap if you try to come over here and attack us. Mm-hmm. So they were just giving a firm hand, just saying, look, we're not going to mess with you, don't mess with us, you mess with us, there's going to be hell to pay. Mm-hmm. That's basically what the Monroe Doctrine was all about. Would to God that we still had mm-hmm. that doctrine today. We would have saved ourselves a lot of problems. Okay. So that's what I have to say about that. The founding quotes and the just war theory and all that kind of thing. So now briefly, it took a little bit longer than I wanted to, but briefly I want to talk about this whole paper money thing and debt, which war generates. And this shouldn't take long. I only have a few verses here. So we have adopted an unbiblical concept of debt and paper money, which our wars are fueled by. Okay, that's, you know, back in the day, as you know, wars are costly now, both in terms of lives and money. You know, they cost lives, and they cost a lot of money. I mean, these wars in Afghanistan and Iraq have cost us trillions of dollars. It's unbelievable. Wars used to be financed either by borrowing or taxing the people. So if the king wanted to go to war, he would levy a tax on people, they'd pay for it, or he'd levy a tax afterwards, they would pay for it, or he would borrow the money. The thing is, you can't only borrow so much before nations don't lend to you anymore, and you can only tax the people so much till they've had enough of war, and they say, no, we're not paying for this anymore, and they stop the war. It's kind of a self-regulating process. It works pretty well. Well, you know, over the years, governments figured out that, hey, it works a lot better just to print up a bunch of money, and then we don't have to tax people, and we don't have to borrow the money, and we can fight wars as long as we want to, until we destroy the currency, which ultimately happens. That ultimately ends up creating inflation and sometimes hyperinflation, which destroys the currency. That happened in the Revolutionary War with the Continental. And that's where, I don't know if you guys learned in school or not about the Continental, that was the currency of the colonies back in the 1700s. And they inflated it, they printed it so much that there became so much of it out there that it was just totally worthless, and that's where the saying, ain't worth a Continental, came from. Mm-hmm. It was just worthless. Same thing happened in the Civil War with the greenback under Lincoln, the same thing. They took them off the gold standard temporarily, started printing up these greenbacks like crazy, ran the greenback into the ground. Basically, they got to where there was such high inflation that they had to go, you know, get rid of the greenback, go back on the gold standard. Same thing happened in Germany in the 1920s after World War I. Mm-hmm. They printed up because they had all those crazy bills to pay and everything else, and they were cut off from other nations and whatever else. They printed their currency to the point where they hyperinflated it. And the bad thing about inflation is a lot of times you print and you print and you print and nothing seems to happen. And you just get a little bit, and all of a sudden it's just, you just break, it's like a crack in the dam, and then it just goes like crazy. And it got to the point where just every year inflation was rising by hundreds of percents. And at the worst of it, it got to the point where you go to a restaurant and you would pay for your meal before you got the meal, because if you waited till afterwards, it would cost twice as much. Mm-hmm. And that's no joke. Mm-hmm. That kind of stuff happened. People get paid twice a day instead of twice a week because the money would be that much worthless, that much more worthless. That's happening in Argentina right now, mm-hmm. I've been told. So anyway, that's what happens when governments ultimately try to print their way, you know, to pay for their wars by printing. Now, the Bible discourages borrowing and debt, so I feel like I'm totally wasted here jabbering on for an hour not having a Bible verse. That's terrible. By the way, before I go here, I just remembered, I found a verse today as I was reading in Proverbs that would have been perfect for the study last time. I did add it to the outline, but I will retroactively just make a point here. You could kind of sum up the whole non-interventionist foreign policy with this verse here in Proverbs 3:30. Which says, strive not with a man without cause, if he have done thee no harm. Mm-hmm. Right there. If our government would just follow that simple little one sentence worth of advice, strive not with a man without cause, if he have done thee no harm. Mm-hmm. It's pretty simple, really. Okay, so the scripture discourages borrowing and debt. Look at Romans 13 and verse 8. And maybe someday I'll do an expanded study on this. This is just the Cliff Note version. Romans 13 and verse 8 says, owe no man anything but to love one another, for he that loveth another hath fulfilled the law. So the only thing that you should owe another person, if at all possible, is to love him. That's the only thing you should owe him. Don't owe him anything else. Don't borrow from people if you don't absolutely have to. Don't borrow from banks if you don't absolutely have to. Stay out of debt. That's the best way to be. And you kids, as you get older, don't get a credit card. If you get a credit card, use it as cash. And what is it? What I mean by that is every time you charge it, you pay it off. So pay it off daily, weekly, or monthly at the most. Don't charge anything on a credit card and leave a balance on there. Don't go out and get yourself a car loan or anything else. Work, save up the money, buy an old clunker, and do it that way. Stay out of debt. Because the Bible says the borrower is servant to the lender. Proverbs 22 and verse 7. Because, I'll tell you, you kids will be targeted big time by all the consumerism out there and this I want it now mentality and instant gratification, and they'll try to talk you into every department store you go to, they'll try to talk you into taking out a credit card, and it's just it's a terrible system. And once you get into it, you get these credit cards and they get 18, 20% interest. You make minimum payments. You'll never pay the things off. That's what they want. You'll be paying on it literally for the rest of your life. The $500 you put on it will end up costing you about $20,000. And it's just an absolutely terrible thing. Proverbs 22 and verse 7. And before I read that, one of my favorite quotes, live small and own it all. Meaning live small and don't have any debt. Own it all. It's a real simple concept. If you can't afford it, don't buy it. Now, a house may be an exception to that. I mean, most people can't afford to buy a house with cash. And if you have a family, it's pretty expensive to rent a house big enough for a family. So it doesn't, financially, I mean, you'd probably never end up owning a house or anything. You'd probably end up renting for the rest of your life because you couldn't afford to save up enough. So that might be one thing. You save up your 20% down payment and that kind of thing. But other than that, I recommend that people don't have any debt at all if you can possibly help it. And, you know, just start out small and, you know, you don't need all the things your parents have whenever you first start out. So anyway, Proverbs 22 and verse 7 says, the rich ruleth over the poor and the borrower is servant to the lender. So whenever you take out that loan at that bank, you have just become a slave. You've just become a servant to that bank. He is now your master, and you don't want to be that, because God tells us, especially Christians, in 1 Corinthians 7 and verse 23, that we are not to be the servants of men. I like preaching the Bible a lot better than I like reading all this other junk. That was tiring. The Bible's so much better. I guess that's why I'm a preacher, not a political commentator or something. 1 Corinthians 7 and verse 23. It says, "You are bought with a price. Be not ye the servants of men. Christ has bought us. Don't be a servant to any bank. Don't be a servant to any man." Just don't go there. Now, looking at this though from a perspective of our country, the USA, our country, is now the largest debtor nation on the earth. You know, just a generation ago, we were the largest creditor nation back in the 70s and probably 80s. The largest creditor nation. Now we're the largest debtor nation. We owe more money than any other nation. Our supposed inferior enemies like China own us. We are their servants. The borrower is servant to the lender. So I ask you, who is going to be ruling who in the future? Mm-hmm. You think we're going to be a military superpower forever? Not when the checks come due. Mm-hmm. Not when the bills come due. It's not going to work. It's not going to happen. We're in for some hard times. The saving and investing are encouraged in the scriptures. It's a fool that spends everything he has and saves nothing. Look at Proverbs 21 and verse 20. Proverbs 21 and verse 20 says, "There is treasure to be desired and oil in the dwelling of the wise, but a foolish man spendeth it up." It's the fool that spends everything and saves nothing. That money just burns a hole in his pocket and he can't save anything. But in the house of the wise, there's going to be treasure and oil desired. He's going to have something. He's going to have some capital saved up. He doesn't spend everything he makes. That's how production works. You work, you spend less than you produce, so you save the rest. You consume less than you produce and save the rest, and that is investment capital by definition. In Proverbs 21 and verse 17, "He that loveth pleasure shall be a poor man. He that loveth wine and oil shall not be rich." So if you're the kind of person that you always have to be going out to eat at a restaurant all the time, and you always have to have the nicest, newest car, and you have to have the going on vacations all the time, and doing all this kind of stuff that costs money, and if you love pleasure, you're going to be a poor man. If you love wine and oil, and you could extrapolate that to all kinds of stuff, you're going to be a poor man. You know, if you have to have a bottle of wine to drink every night, you're going to be a poor man. The Bible, you know, like I said, I mean, the Bible encourages, you can see from these verses, it encourages saving and consuming less than you produce and living below your means. China, on the other hand, as opposed to us, has been saving and investing and buying up natural resources, while the U.S. has been building bombs and making war for who knows how long. So while we've been goofing around over there in the Middle East and intervening in country after country, and starting war after war after war, and spending trillions of dollars, China hasn't been fighting any wars. China's been going over to Africa and buying up natural resources. China's been buying up stuff here, buying up real estate now, buying up roads and all kinds of stuff. Who are the wise ones here? I mean, are we fools or what? It's unbelievable. A paper or fiat currency, fiat means by decree. See, if you have a gold coin, nobody needs to tell you that's money. No government needs to say, hey, that's worth something. No. If you get a paper dollar, somebody needs to tell you that thing's worth something, right? Or else you're not going to think it's worth anything.
Right.
You know, if I gave you a piece of paper and I wrote on it dollar, I would have to do a lot of convincing to convince you this is worth something.
Right.
You know, so that's what fiat is, by declaration. Fiat currency, which finances wars, is unbiblical. I mean, there's certainly no biblical pattern for it. I mean, would having a paper money system that was fully backed by gold like we used to have in this country, would that be ungodly? I don't think so. But having a paper money system to where it's not backed with anything, it doesn't represent anything, I would say that that is not scriptural. It's certainly not scriptural. I mean, is it ungodly? Is it sinful? I don't know, but it's certainly not scriptural. Look in Genesis 23. You see, money should be defined by weight. And there's a lot of verses. I'm just going to give you a string of three of them here quickly. Genesis 23 in verse 16, this is true money. True money has weight to it. Genesis 23, verse 16, this is when Abraham bought, I think it was when he bought the plot of ground off the sons of Heth. And it says there, "And Abraham hearkened unto Ephron, and Abraham weighed to Ephron the silver which he had named in the audience of the sons of Heth, 400 shekels of silver, current money with the merchant. He weighed it out to him. The silver had a weight to it. Now, what is the difference in weight between a $1 bill and a $100 bill?
Right.
Nothing. They don't weigh any different whatsoever. Now, if they were backed by gold, what they represented would weigh differently. So that would be a different story. But this paper money that we have, there's no weight to it. There's no difference. It's all intrinsically, a $100 bill is worth the same thing as a $1 bill. Intrinsically, meaning all by itself. If you couldn't use it for money, it's worth no more than the $1 bill is.
Mm-hmm.
Genesis 43 and verse 21. Genesis 43, 21. And it came to pass when we came to the inn that we opened our sacks. This is whenever Joseph's brethren came to Egypt to get corn whenever they're having the drought. We came to the inn, we opened our sacks, and behold, every man's money was in the mouth of his sack, our money in full weight, and we have brought it again in our hand. And money in full weight. I'm going to give you one more, Jeremiah 32 and verse 9. In the mouth of three witnesses here. Jeremiah 32:9. This is when Jeremiah bought a plot of ground. God told him that, hey, after the Babylonian captivity, you're going to come back. And so go ahead and buy yourself a plot of ground, get yourself the deed for it and everything. And in Jeremiah 32 and verse 9, I believe this is what this is speaking of here. I could be corrected if I'm wrong, but I'm pretty sure that's what this is talking about. It says, "And I bought the field of Hanamel, my uncle's son, that was in Hanathoth, and weighed him the money, even 17 shekels of silver." He weighed him the money. Mm-hmm. Now, in the law of Moses, it required just weights and measures. Look in Leviticus 19, 35 and 36. See, God takes this money seriously. When you start messing with money, God requires just weights and measures, not be ripping people off, not changing the value of their money on them. Leviticus 19, 35 through 36. Leviticus 19, 35 and 36. "Ye shall do no unrighteousness in judgment, in meat yard, in weight, or in measure, just balances, just weights, a just ephah." An ephah was a measurement of something, like a volumetric measurement. "And a just hin shall ye have. I am the Lord your God, which brought you out of the land of Egypt." So just balances, just weights, and a just ephah. Meaning that have you guys used balances in science class before when you weighed things on a balance? You know, so you have the weight, you put the weight on the one side of the balance and you weigh whatever you're going to weigh on the other side. I don't know if we probably even use balances like that. Usually you get the balance with the where you slide the weight. Mm-hmm. Same kind of concept. You slide the weight along the little track there. But the old balance is you put a certain amount of weight here and then you'd find the right amount of stuff to match that weight. So God says just balances, just weights, and a just ephah, just volume. If you got a gallon, it better be a gallon. It better not be 3/4 of a gallon masquerading itself as a gallon.
Mm-hmm.
God hates falsifying balances and robbing people by deceit. This is going to be my last point. In Amos 8 and verse 5, this is what some of those bankster Jews were doing back then. They've been doing this stuff for a while. Amos 8 and verse 5. These guys just couldn't wait until the religious observance was over so they could rip people off again. Just, you know, you gotta wait until church is over on Sunday so we can go out there and start screwing people again. It says there in Amos 8 and verse 5, saying, "When will the new moon be gone that we may sell corn, and the Sabbath that we may set forth wheat, making the ephah small and the shekel great, and falsifying the balances by deceit?" Mm-hmm. See, they were making the ephah. So think about this. Somebody comes to them, they're going to buy some wheat. They're going to buy an ephah of wheat from them, okay? So they make the ephah small. So you say, here's your bushel of wheat. Here's your ephah of wheat, but it's not really an ephah. It's only, you know, maybe 75% of an ephah, but they're saying it's an ephah. So the people are getting less than they think they're getting. And they say making the shekel great. So they're making the shekel weight of the money great. So what they do is say, here's an ephah, I'm going to give you a wheat. Okay, I'm going to charge you a shekel of gold for that, or a shekel of silver. Here's my shekel on one side of the balance. Put your silver on the other side of the balance. Only my shekel is actually two shekels. I got twice as much weight here, so you got to put twice as much silver to balance it out.
Wheat, you mean on the other side?
No. So if you got the ephah of wheat, so yeah. We've already agreed here, this is not really an ephah, but I'm saying it's an ephah.
Right.
Okay.
Something less.
And now I'm going to weigh out the money. Mm-hmm. I think maybe you could say you're going to weigh the wheat too. I mean, you could do the same thing, but if you're going to weigh the money, because the shekels were used to measure silver and gold, mm-hmm. the shekels of silver. So back then, if you didn't have coins, if you just had a block of silver, you say, okay, I want, two shekels of silver, which may have been, 3 ounces or something. I have no idea what a shekel was. So you say, I want a shekel of silver, so here's my shekel, quote unquote, and it's actually 3 shekels. So I put my weight on one side, and this guy starts putting his silver on one side. He's like, well, I don't remember a shekel being that much silver. Well, I guess it is. It says shekel there, and he weighs it out there. So he just paid more silver than he was supposed to pay, and he got less money. You know what that's called? It's called inflation. That's exactly what the Federal Reserve does. They inflate the money supply, which drives down the value of your money, and you got to pile more dollar bills on there to buy the same weight of stuff that you could have last year. Mm-hmm. That's what inflation does. It devalues the currency.
Pastor Wagner, according to the Coinage Act of 1792, which was the law that set the mint in the U.S., originally set the mint in the U.S., mm-hmm. dollar is defined as a unit of measure.
That's right.
So we've really entered in a new world of brave think when we are talking about measurements and units of measurements and so forth. Because
absolutely.
The dollar had a certain weight of gold or silver in coin form laid out by that law, which has never been repealed.
Yep.
So the Coinage Act of 1792 was rewritten into U.S. code, but it was just lifted and transposed there.
Yep.
So if Congress had the power to declare anything other than gold or silver, they haven't used it, and they don't have that power.
Right. Yeah, and the Constitution is clear that Congress, that only gold and silver shall be coined. Congress has the power to coin gold and silver.
Yep.
And you're right, I think the dollar was 371 grains of silver and like 20 some grains of gold or something like that.
Right. And a certain purity and fineness, which the shekel probably could have been a unit of measure as well. The dollar, the shekel, these are units of measure, because units of measure are subjective. You have to apply them to something objective.
Yes.
To have a dollar of a dollar would be like having an inch of an inch.
Yeah.
And you get into this crazy thinking.
Yeah.
And if you think crazy long enough, you probably go insane.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
The brain complies, yeah.
Yeah, because, there is no definition of a dollar now. A dollar is just a unit of currency, that there's no definition. I mean, there's no standard definition. A dollar today doesn't buy what a dollar might tomorrow. I mean, there's nothing there. Yeah,
absolutely. I have heard the Federal Reserve go before Congress and say that our currency today is monetized debt, which is debt used as money.
Yeah.
So in that sense, now we're using the portion of something owed as the payment for that portion of something owed.
Yeah.
And I guess the double thing just carries on in ad nauseum.
Yeah, I mean, it's ridiculous. And really what the dollar, they say, is based on the full faith and credit of the United States government, is the value of the dollar,
mm-hmm.
is based on the credit of the government to pay it back.
Right.
Is what it's worth, supposedly. So if you have as much confidence in the U.S. government as I do, then the dollar's not worth a whole lot to you.
Right. They say it's the GNP, gross national product, that backs the dollar.
Yeah.
But in the term back, they mean redemption. Logically speaking, if they were to define their term, they mean you can redeem it, which means they have GNP laid aside in little silos so you can go redeem your paper for the GNP, which you can.
It's absurd. Yeah.
Right,
it's totally absurd. You can't redeem good faith and credit or anything.
Right.
There's nothing redemptive about it, no. The best thing you can do is take all the extra ones you have and put it into something of real value, and then the next guy that sold it to you, he can do what he needs to get rid of it too. But
mm-hmm.
yeah, absolutely. So yeah, falsifying the balances by deceit is what Ben Bernanke and the Federal Reserve do every day. Proverbs 20 and verse 20. This will be the last verse. Bernanke doesn't even think gold is money. Ron Paul asked him in a hearing with the Fed if gold is money. He asked him if gold is money, and he said no. He didn't think it was money. It's been money for 6,000 years.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody admits that.
Mm-hmm.
No, it's not money. He said, why do central banks hold it? Tradition? That's what he said. Habit or something like that? He's like, why don't they hold diamonds? I don't know. You're the head of the financial system of the world? Come on, where did we get these guys? Proverbs 20 and verse 10. he's wise, so he's getting out before the crap hits the fan. Mm-hmm. You know, because the poor next guy that comes in after him, you couldn't pay me all the money in the world times 10 mm-hmm. to be the chairman of the Federal Reserve in the next coming 5 years.
I think, you know who they have in mind for that is ex-President Bush.
Really?
He's going to go in there and fix it. I'm going to say that it's late money. Go.
Oh.
He'd be great at it, though.
Yeah,
I mean, I'm telling you, he could do it.
He couldn't be any worse than Bernanke, no. I don't think. Wow. Oh, yeah, Proverbs 20, what did I say? 2010. That's Psalms. That does not, that didn't look right at all. Proverbs 20 and verse 10. Divers weights and divers measures, that means a whole bunch of them, various ones. Divers weights and divers measures, both of them are alike abomination to the Lord. Mm. Abomination is the feeling of combined disgust and hatred. Mm-hmm. God is disgusted and hates divers weights and divers measures. When you're cheating people, scamming them, changing the terms on them, God hates that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. So this is what inflation does to it, the savers in society. It robs them by deceit. And wars would be fought far less frequently on a gold standard. Why do you think they got us off the gold standard? They want, I mean, you can't have unlimited government, you can't have all these social programs, and you can't buy the votes and everything else, and you can't have these unending wars so the bankers can pad the pockets of all their buddies. You can't do that with a gold standard. You gotta have paper money, and that's why they've done it. So anyway, that's a study for tonight. That was kind of a mix mash there of a bunch of different stuff, but I hope it was of some profit to you anyway.
Yes.